Hello and welcome to the Mystic Cast, where you join Jack Stafford and Deborah Littleboy, members of the Aetherius Society, the cosmic religion for the Aquarian Age, as we break down the barriers between religion, science, metaphysics, philosophy, and mysticism, all of which are really only aspects of the selfsame quest for truth. Please note, this is an independent program, not produced or fact-checked by the Aetherius Society. Today, our guest is Gary Kidgel. Hello, Gary.
Hello, Jack.
Wonderful to have you on the show.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
And you're from one of our the closest related religions to the Aetherius Society, the Theosophical Society.
Yes, I'm a member of the Theosophical Society. That is correct, yes.
And you've been involved for 40 years, is that something like that?
My study of metaphysics goes back 40 years. The Theosophical Society goes back 29 years. I am also connected with the Claregate group, which arose from the teachings of Dr. Douglas Baker, who was an English who had an ashram in Hertfordshire up until 2011 when he passed. So that is my background in metaphysics, really. Baker, then theosophy, and well, I do my own thing as well. I'm an esoteric astrologer, and I'm a writer and a librarian for a metaphysical
library. What first attracted you to the Theosophical Societies? Because it's quite difficult to get into, you know, the secret doctrines are quite heavy going.
Yeah, well, I actually used to run an astrology group in Dundee, which morphed into a metaphysical group, studying the teachings, both of Douglas Baker and the related teachings of Alice Bailey. Of course, the Bailey teachings were a forerunner to Baker's and, of course, came after Theosophy. One of our group members was a Theosophist and suggested we become a local Theosophical Lodge. So that was my entree to the Theosophical Society. I've given numerous lectures both here in Scotland and down south. I've lectured internationally as well.
And on your travels, did you hear about the Aetherius Society before now?
I heard about the Aetherius Society from Douglas Baker initially, because I think he was acquainted with Benjamin Krem. He either knew him or knew of him. And of course, you know, Benjamin Krem was a former member of the society. I don't know if he remained a member. I don't know that sort of history. You probably will.
I think there was something about he went to Lord Maitreya and he was in communication with him and they parted ways, but I don't know the history accurately.
As far as I know, he was also Arcane School, the Bailey group, and I think they parted ways probably about the same time as the Aetherius Society and Benjamin Krem. He kind of went on, what would you call it, a maverick quest or maverick mission?
Yeah, you could write an interesting book about how these societies relate to each other and members go off here and there. And so when you first, because the Aetherius Society is the Theosophical Society was founded by the Ascended Masters. So those who've gone through the initiation of ascension, the masters, they live in Mount Shasta, they live in various retreats around the world, and they communicated through Madame Blavatsky, and they visualized it into being, and she took it through. And then the Aetherius Society was envisaged by the cosmic masters, and they also, with the help of the Great White Brotherhood and Dr. King, he carried it through for them. So When you heard about it, just because most of our listeners are members and sympathizers of the Aetherius Society, what's your impressions of the teachings?
I would have to study them in great depth to comment, but I see a lot of similarities, i.e. George King being inspired by higher beings, just as Blavatsky was. She cited the masters Moria and Katumi and latterly Joao Kull, who was the one connected with Alice Bailey, and Blavatsky and Alcott and Henry Steele Alcott and William Quan Judge founded the Theosophical Society. at the behest of masters, as you say. So there are certain similarities there. And you maybe know Theosophy is all about creating a universal brotherhood, which really is founded on the spiritual principle that there is one divine life and we are all aspects of that one divine life. So it's therefore a brotherhood without distinction of race, creed, sex, caste, or color, which is a very sort of obvious statement to make nowadays. It was not in Victorian times in the UK. Britain had a vast empire at that time, and things were very different. And Theosophy encourages the study of comparative religion, science, philosophy, etc., and investigates the powers latent within.
I'm just super interested in how these hands behind the scenes work, because there was a lot of spiritualism in the 19th century that...
Very much so, yes.
Which kind of... It was kind of...
Blavatsky and Alcott met at a spiritualist meeting in Vermont. That was how they became acquainted, because Alcott was a journalist investigating spiritualist phenomena, whereas Blavatsky simply wished to attend. I mean, she had certain psychic powers and capacities along those lines, but she was always, I wouldn't describe her as anti-spiritualist, but she mentioned a very strong caveat about it and it being dangerous, people giving up their bodies to discarnate entities.
Yep.
And
negative trance, yeah.
The astral plane being very illusory, and how discarnate entities can masquerade as historical figures imparting information to psychics and mediums. Of course, the main thing there is, if one judges spiritual teachings by their content and quality rather than by the claims as to who imparted them, I think if anyone read Blavatsky's Secret Doctrine, they would be very quickly become aware of the great capacity of the authors of that particular book. I mean, even modern AI could not compile something of that nature. Also, a lot of the content is new as well, or it was new at that time.
Oh, yes. So I think she was well above spiritualism and didn't agree with it. But behind the scenes, it was the masters did decide that between the realms, there would be more fluidity at that time to help people understand. It was a decision. And the same with there were these seances and it was able to take place, and it's not happening now in the same way. And it's the same with the UFOs. It was taken as a decision to it, as visibility, to raise the consciousness of people and awareness that there is this other life at different frequencies. So I see that always as a bit of a reflection in the master's workings.
Very much so. I mean, Theosophy also arose to counteract materialistic science. We look at the situation humanity is in today through strong adherence to materialistic science and a breakdown in religion. Now, I'm not for religious dogma, but when there is not belief in a higher power, certain individuals start to believe they are the higher power, or the egos run rampant. And there's such a high incidence of mental health issues today as well. There clearly has to be a revolution in consciousness. And as you allude to, these various outpourings of teachings are all part of this process. People become aware of higher things and that they have a purpose beyond that of their transient personality goals.
Mm-hmm. Maybe that brings us into your lecture on Hylozoism. I know I'm saying that wrong. Maybe you could correct me.
No, yes. That forms a basis of Blavatsky's Secret Doctrine. The word is derived from the Greek. It's a compound word. Hylo means matter and Zoe means life. And we say that all forms are infused with the life of the divine. and all forms provide vehicles through which aspects of the divine life at varying stages of evolution are able to develop and express spiritual qualities. I think any spiritual seeker, it's important that they're aware that the rich diversity of forms within our world that the divine life assumes function as these vehicles by which aspects of the divine life, which theosophy would call monads, a term taken from Leibniz, the philosopher, monads at various stages of a long evolutionary journey, and develop and express hitherto latent spiritual qualities. This concept of hylozoism, it's not new to theosophy, of course. All of the various pantheistic religions of our world were, to a degree, acknowledging this and developing practices on this basis. You have American Indians, ancient Middle Easterns, Japanese Shinto, and of course the various pagan traditions in the West. Certain Greek philosophers embraced this, as did Zarathustra and Paracelsus, a medieval physician and alchemist. And this is symbolically depicted in various creation myths. Probably the best known is the Indian one of Purusha, a word meaning spirit, who is sacrificed, and his bodily parts then giving rise to creation. All of the entities of the universe are produced from his dismembered body. And various Indian teachings, such as Jainism, Samkhya, Yoga, describe how Purusha infuses Prakriti, Purusha spirit, Prakriti matter. Then this was taken further by the teachings of Advaita Vedanta, which state that the divine life, Brahman, is both transcendent of, yet also immanent within all forms. And this is really what hylozoism is about. We are part of a living universe which is infused by the energies of a transcendent being. Obviously, an immense transcendent being, which in terms of your own teachings, you know, with the 12 blessings, you say, blessed is the absolute. So I would immediately relate that, well, beyond Brahman, Parabrahman, the great transcendent entity who is mentioned in Blavatsky's Secret Doctrine. And then blessed are the supreme lords of creation. We would call these the energies of the seven rays, the seven great universal builders, described in Blavatsky's Secret Doctrine in various terms, including the Ahi, or the seven breaths of the dragon of wisdom. So, you know, theosophy does present a wonderful paradigm in terms of the creative process, but to keep it simple, all matter is infused with life, the life of the divine, and it serves an evolutionary purpose.
Yeah, that really makes sense. That resonates with our teachings. We exist in a sea of mind, and consciousness is mind slowed down. That's what I've learned from my metaphysical studies. So we're all at different frequencies. We're evolving back to God. And so we form, consciousness accumulates in greater beings as we evolve back to God. So the earth is a living being. Eventually, yes, many of us will get together and form a planet. Planets eventually form suns. The galaxy is a living being. Everything's evolving because there was the great outbreath. And now we're all going back to God, but we have to go back as, you know, in a bigger format.
That is almost identical, really, to teachings of theosophy and Bailey. We would say creation would arise from one of the cosmic planes called Mahat, the universal mind. And from there, galaxies, solar systems, planets would be formed, because theosophy would say that we are part of the consciousness of a great solar being called Solar Logos. That is us, in essence, what theosophy calls the monad. And the soul of being projects the monads down the planes of consciousness as part of the vast evolutionary process. But bearing in mind, the soul of Logos is evolving too, but it can only evolve through the monads, its component parts evolving. And that's why we go on this long evolutionary journey to acquire spiritual qualities that were hitherto latent. We say that we are here to acquire spiritual staying power, this being the ability to radiate and express divine qualities, regardless of the restrictions imposed upon us by matter, of course, of which there are many. And our planet is a chakra within the body of the solar being, which is in turn a chakra within a greater entity. But we say that the souls of humanity, the soul functioning as an instrument of the monad, they all comprise the consciousness of the planetary being. And the soul unfolds its symbolic lotus petals through its successive personalities, of which there are many. The soul will adopt personalities in the various races and cultures of our world. And when we connect to the soul through spiritual disciplines, meditation, study, service, we build a bridge to the soul. We call it the Antakarana or Rainbow Bridge. And on this basis, we can access and express spiritual qualities related to the soul on behalf of its Father in Heaven, the monad. So things like compassion, empathy, unconditional love, inclusive forms of love, etc. And when we do this, when we are connected with the soul, we are also sharing, albeit very slightly, in the energies and powers of the greater being which the soul is a part of, the planet, planetary logos, planetary lord. And when we evolve, the planetary lord evolves, the solar lord evolves, and so on. And when we tread the spiritual path, we are seeking what theosophical and related teachings describe as initiation. Carl Jung spoke of individuation. He's basically saying the same thing, where soul and personality function as one. And this, of course, initiation leads to elevations in consciousness and awareness of the intent of the planetary life we are a part of. In the Bible, we have Moses ascending Mount Sinai and receiving the tablets of law, i.e. being aware of the divine intent at that particular time. And that is what we are seeking to do. But just as we are seeking to link soul and personality at a much higher level, so is the planetary being, which we are a part of, so is the solar being. So this spiritual development and initiation is going on at all levels. This is in accordance with the great axiom of Hermes Trismegistus on the Emerald Tablet, as above, so below.
Wow, that really resonates exactly with our teachings. Yes, and also when that we are holding up the evolution of the Mother Earth by our bad thoughts and actions. We're holding up the galaxy as well, because the galaxy cannot return to God while we still are. And we're under this materialistic prison also, but in time as well is an imposed limitation which doesn't exist above, or exists maybe in a different way above. But
I agree. And I think our thoughts as well, and the thoughts of humanity throughout the ages, have created energy reservoirs which affect us, which Carl Jung called archetypes. And we must raise our consciousness beyond these and access and express the energies of the divine intent, the pure archetypes, the planes of consciousness. These are related to the planes of consciousness where we find soul and spirit. It's by basically rendering ourselves as a spiritual vessel. This is the alchemist transmuting the base metal of the personality, which is transient, into the gold, the incorruptible, immortal gold of the soul. In doing so, as you say, the greater lives which we are a part of evolve. As we undergo these higher initiations, eventually we are liberated from the wheel of rebirth. And as you mentioned earlier, we pass on to higher evolutionary powers, eventually perhaps becoming angelic, perhaps becoming a planetary lord. I mean, this is vast, of course. It's, you know, your average person would say, well, it's well out there. And in many ways it is when we're down here in matter and we've got work to do. But you alluded to this as well, when Siddhartha attained enlightenment, becoming the Buddha, he then took the Bodhisattva path where he would renounce the state of nirvana until every human being had proceeded to that state. And that illustrates the awareness of someone at that level of the interconnectedness of all life, and everything has to evolve and go back to the divine. And so the more we evolve, the more we become involved in the evolutionary process and the divine intent, the Bodhisattva path.
That's great that you pick up on that. That's a great point to mention. Yeah, and that was one of the subtleties that Dr. King mentioned with regard to the teachings, is that you could go on to a higher, you decline the initiation, you step back and you serve. And that's the greatness of the Mother Earth or the galaxy or the Bodhisattva, refusing an initiation and staying back to do a job that you don't have to do, but you're doing it for the benefit of others.
So, in Douglas Baker would speak of Nirmanakayas, obviously, like a lot of theosophical terms are Eastern because there are not Western equivalents. I think if you translated the Sanskrit there, it would be nir means no. I think mana means mind, or manas means mind, and kaya means body. So someone at an evolutionary stage where the soul no longer requires to incarnate, but these Nirmanakayas renounce the nirvanic state like the Buddha and rather stay behind to inspire humanity, either taking on a body or inspiring someone in a body, a soul in a body. And Baker and others would relate all of the great ideas of humanity to the Nirmanakayas. Individuals like Plato, for example, you know, would be a Nirmanakaya. Someone like Leonardo da Vinci and so on. You know, they're coming up with ideas that greatly advance the human condition. It's very much about new things. And they are related to the alter ego of the Earth, the planet Venus. We say that the ideas of Venusian, they're inspired by Venus, and ultimately Venus is related to Sirius. This is all relevant to the process of initiation. I mean, it can get very intricate. I'm trying to just talk in principles because, you know, we're part of a vast cosmic scheme here. But yeah, I think when I looked at the literature you sent me, I thought right away there are a lot of similarities here between Theosophy and Bailey. And really, the Bailey teachings are an offshoot, or many would say a continuation of theosophical teachings, depending on one's perspective, of course.
When I first heard of these ideas, they were very new to me. I hadn't heard them anywhere else, especially the nine freedoms, because, you know, I came from more of a Buddhist background, and that once you attain nirvana, that's it, back to God, game over, graduated. But yes. Apparently, that's only one turn of the wheel. So then you can break the reincarnatory cycle, but you don't break the incarnatory cycle. Reincarnation is an unconscious process, and you get to choose whether you can go. So once you've raised the Kundalini all the way confidently many times, you enlightenment, cosmic consciousness, ascension, then you can choose to stay back to serve, as we mentioned, with the Great White Brotherhood, or you can go on. Then you go on to another. Well, eventually you're going to have to go on to another classroom, Mars, Venus, Jupiter, one of the other classrooms. And then you go to Saturnian existence. That's the eighth freedom. The ninth freedom is solar existence. Then you exist on the sun as a, that's that. But then there are many more incarnations above that as you have to go on, but that's as much as we could cope with, apparently.
Yeah, no, I understand, because anyone who consults theosophical literature or Bailey or Rudolf Steiner, they will see a diagram of seven planes of existence, seven levels of consciousness. Obviously, one is trying to depict a multidimensional creation in 2D, you know, but it's a useful paradigm. And you have at the top spirit or monad, you have the planes of the soul, and you have the planes of the personality. I won't elaborate, but I want to mention this because that is simply known as the cosmic physical plane, Prakriti. You then have six higher cosmic planes, you know, from which creation arises, from which the various beings such as the solar logos develop the idea, probably on the cosmic mental plane, to incarnate. And but of course, they're subject to laws as well. But I'm just really wanting to illustrate how vast it is. And of course, Hylozoism, we don't just think of the natural world here and the inhabitants. We say, well, all planets are living, and they may not have physical life, but they may have etheric, emotional, mental, and certainly spiritual life. And it also applies to our thoughts, of course. Thoughts are living things. And that's very important. And that is why Christians, Buddhists, etc., affirm certain codes of conduct. I think something else I really need to mention is the fact that because we live within the body of a greater being, we are subject to its rhythms and impulses, also its thoughts and actions, and its karma. If I could perhaps use an analogy of the cells in my body, if I'm perhaps under stress, perhaps fleeing from someone, all the bodily parts are under stress, and we are part of a planetary consciousness. Douglas Baker stated that the Earth has a difficult, painful karma, the being that ensouls the Earth, and the esoteric teachings relating to Christ dying for the sins of humanity relates to an advanced soul taking a greater share of the planetary karma, a share above and beyond its own, because it's an esoteric proposition that souls on the path, etc., are expected not just to deal with their own karma, but some of the planetary karma. It's not distributed equally amongst the billions of monads operating through our solar system and through our planet, of which the theosophers Leadbeater stated there were 63 billion, but rather souls who have unfolded their consciousness more are expected to take on more karma.
Well, that's very interesting. We're told that the Master Jesus came here. He's a Venusian, from the, as it says in the Bible, the prophet from the bright and morning star, and he incarnated to die at a specific time, to take on some karma that was due to us, and to avoid a disaster that was due to take at that time, which would have held up our evolution many thousands of years. So yeah, he didn't die to take our sins, but it was a karmic manipulation to die at that specific time. Do you also the civilization of do you also believe in the Maldek, that we came from the planet Maldek, which is now the asteroid belt, which we destroyed, and then we came to live on this Earth after that?
That is completely new to me. Completely.
Okay. Oh, okay. That's well, yeah, if you look at Bode's law, the distance of the planets, there is this, where there should be a planet, there is the asteroid belt. And so we have the negative karma, not the Mother Earth. And she had to, these realms that I understand that each chakra is a realm of consciousness. So when we die, we go to the realm of just desserts. We go and live there for a while, burn off some more karma, have some more experiences, come back here to this realm. And the Mother Earth had to create those because they didn't exist. It was Adamic man on this Earth 18 million years ago, which was before us, and they didn't have, their root chakra was the heart chakra. So everything below the heart chakra is an abomination, really. They didn't reproduce through sex organs. They didn't digest food. They could live off the rays of the sun. And
that's interesting, because there are certain parallels there, because Theosophical writings, Blavatsky's Secret Doctrine, talks of humanity reaching physical form on the Earth 18 million years ago. There was life on the moon before, and the Logos, or Lord of the Moon, died at an early age, and a number of the souls of part of the moon chain were transferred to the Earth. Humanity is a mixture of people who individualized, that is, became human from the animal kingdom on Earth, and some who had done so earlier on the moon chain. Blavatsky talks of evolution on the Earth. The pinnacle of it prior to humanity's arrival would be anthropoid-like structures, and very gross. And humanity, not the moon chain ones, the other ones, were before that, were reproducing through things like budding and binary fusion and so on. Then humanity merged with the anthropoids and etheric, or what we would now call subatomic level, as a means of refining these anthropoids so that human souls could then occupy them. An interesting offshoot to that, according to Blavatsky, is the modern apes resulted through interbreeding between humans occupying anthropoid thought forms and the original anthropoid animals. And therefore, the apes are in something of a cul-de-sac they will eventually die out. It's a fascinating fact that apes are more intelligent when they're young than they are when they get older. You know, which, I could be sarcastic and say that applies to some humans, but I'm sure you know what I'm driving at. It's a fascinating fact. Of course, the idea of interbreeding 18 million years ago, it sounds a bit gross, miscegenation, but obviously the human forms were very gross at that time as well. That was what Theosophy would call the Lemurian continent, where it was about creating the physical body, then followed by the Atlantean, then the development of the emotions or astral body, and now we're developing the mental body or mind. We're halfway there. We've developed the intellect, but the higher abstract mind awaits development.
That ties in definitely the Lemurian civilization. We had, karmically, we had to crawl back from the mud. We had to go through all these experiences again. And then we probed the atom and destroyed ourselves again. The Earth turned on its axis. And then we went through Atlantis. It's very flippant to sum up human history. But just to go back to it was said that the Senet Kumar came and established Shambhala.
Yeah.
And they were, not say genetic experimentation, but they had to give us help create the vehicles of expression for us, that we could go through to evolve karmically. And so they gave us these bodies, and which, you know, when you think about it, I mean, what do people on other worlds must they do? You know, what one of the great, you know, scientists are already experimenting with creating forms, aren't they, and cloning, and we're still on the snail stage of evolution. So creating life, like I think it was the bumblebee came from Venus or something like that, or
well, that with yes, that's kind of Theosophical teachings, as you mentioned, Senet Kumara, of course, and Shambhala, you know, which is the head center of the planetary being. But Bailey teachings in the Great Invocation talk of from the center where the will of God is known.
What was the beginning then, 18 million years ago? What was the impetus for
that? Was the materialization of humanity into physical form. It wasn't the beginning, obviously, not the beginning of the beginning of creation itself. Mm. Theosophy talks about rounds and chains, and as well as the Earth, there are six other counterpart globes. The Earth is the physical one, but Globe A and Globe F. The lowest level they reach is mental, B and E, astral, C and not B and E, B and F. Sorry, A and G, B and F, C and E, etheric or subatomic, and D being physical. And there are seven rounds where the life wave passes through these. So we're talking sort of billions of years here. But we theosophy would say life will, at some point after the various seven races, etc., will move to globe D, etheric, and then the whole process will start again, and it happens seven times. But, you know, this is a very intricate, very involved way of describing the process of creation and mm-hmm. what it's all about and how evolution takes place. I'm not in any way detracting from the need for us all to work on ourselves with our spiritual practices, because I do think with theosophy and related teaching, there's a danger of over-intellectualizing and over-theorizing. And I did say to one of my friends, if you buy a car, you don't spend your life reading the manual and breaking it down. You actually drive it, you know, and that is part of the process. But of course, when you study your teachings, I study mine, it gives you a far greater appreciation of life and the role that we have to play. It enables you, one, to appreciate other people much more in the various life forms within the different kingdoms of nature and so on.
Oh, I mean, yeah, we're talking about things that are way above our pay grade, the greatest truth.
Yeah,
but this
very much, it's, yeah.
It's fun to talk about. But yeah, you're right. We should, and all keep in mind the living, breathing Mother Earth, which we don't, you know, none of us thank before we build, ask permission before we build our houses, or thank every day for the right experience.
Absolutely. I think it's worth mentioning with Hylozoism and us all living within the body of greater beings that astrology is essentially a study of the physiology of our universe. I would say astronomers look at the anatomy of the universe. They do it very well, but they're not describing how the component parts interact, and they do so at subtle levels. And when one is looking at a birth chart, certainly the way I do it, you're looking at the purpose of the soul and how one can effectively function as a cell within the universe, fulfilling its purpose, flowing with the cosmic intent.
And that our higher selves chose, that specific point of time to be born. So we'd have certain skills so we could fulfill a certain goal in each life.
Absolutely. The soul will choose a point in time and space related to its purpose for the life ahead, and of course related to the karma which it is carrying and which it expects to dispense with in the life in question.
Back to what you said about the getting too caught up in theory, that's, we're told that a new language has been put into being, the language of direct action, and these are the days of service, these are the end of times, we have to be of service. This karma yoga is now that is the fastest yoga. It used to be that karma yoga was, because all the yogas are about union with God. They're all about raising our consciousness. But it always, karma yoga was, you know, it used to be that you should go in a cave, work on yourself, do your practices. But that doesn't line up with the other planets, you know. It's all about service to others. And so the Aetherius Society is sort of a spiritual commando force. We pray into batteries. We release these batteries at times of crisis. And we take through direct action. We pray, like we send the energy out into these batteries, which are filled with crystals, and they stores the energy. And then, when there are these disasters, you can't get 1,000 people to pray all together at one time. You should be able to, but unfortunately, it's not the world we live in. So you can direct these energies to release relief for a hurricane or an earthquake or during peace talks. And we've had fantastic results with that.
course, because as you'll be aware, it's not merely the physical event, it's the effect at emotional and mental levels, etc. And the sort of quagmire it's creating, especially emotionally, and that has to be dealt with, just as we have to deal with elements of our astral body that prevent the soul from shining its light downwards. The planetary lord is having to do the same. And given that we are driven into incarnation initially by desire, well, early stages of the soul's incarnations on Earth, it's driven by desire, and that's healthy because the soul's wanting to experience all that life and form has to offer. But when one awakens to the fact there is more to life than everyday events, that is when desire must be overcome. It must be transmuted, and that's very important too. And just as in your own society, theosophy and related groups would emphasize service. We talk of study, meditation, and service, but I think most of us would agree service is the most important. Again, we're all part of one creation. We're all one man, to use a hippie phrase, but you know, it's an obvious extension of the hylozoistic principle. If we're all part of the greater being, then of course we should be serving. You know, that is the bodhisattva path and so on. And growing up in the West, of course, we're not really brought up to think that way. I think we live in a culture that where the individual ego is emphasized, and to climb on top of the pile, to be the cynosure of all eyes, to shine above others and so on. You know, it hits us every day through the media, you know, whether it's newspapers, social media, television, and so on. There's far too much emphasis on ego.
Well, I mean, yeah, you get the spirit, you get the religion you deserve, no? And you get the spiritual path you deserve. So we're taught in the New Age teachings, which are a reflection of our modern society, that, you know, you can, before my own experience, I thought the best thing you could die with was a peaceful mind, you know, just spend all your time meditating and get control of your own mind and be peaceful. And that was enough action to take, you know, but that's really, you could be a bit of a bastard, die, you know, with very poor mental control. But if you, you know, if you worked with love in an orphanage every day, you're accelerating light years past a monk who just sits all the day in his own in contemplation.
I think that's very interesting. I think you've raised a very important point, especially for people now. It's the Aquarian age, the Piscean age. It was valid to retreat and live in a monastery, etc. This is the age of humanity. And especially in the West, in the East, you had the four asramas or stages. You had the student, the householder. Then probably in midlife, the householder would leave the family and kids, retreat into the forest, perhaps become a wandering monk, a sadhu, and so on. But in the West, we must develop and express our spirituality in the humdrum material world and not all that it entails. I think it's a great test, because if we can remain connected to the soul and express its energies and qualities in a sort of rubbish materialist society, then if we can do it there, we can do it anywhere.
Oh, that's beautiful. Yeah. You should check out, as you're an astrologer, you should check out Dr. King's chart, because he's the master for the Aquarian age. So Jesus was the master for the Piscean age. So Dr. King embodies all of the qualities for the of the Aquarian. And he's very interesting.
Yeah, it's very important with astrology to be aware that one is given a certain hand to play with the chart, but it's obviously related to the evolutionary status and the vibratory rate of this individual concerned, the development of the soul and how connected they are to the planetary and perhaps the solar consciousness. It's rather like quantum superpositioning. You have placements in the chart that can be expressed at many different levels. That is why astrology is an art, and a good astrologer will attune to their client and see how the archetypes are working. But you can see certain things in different charts, but it's certainly not always the case that advanced souls have what one might call favorable or easy charts. It's often the contrary.
It's true. Yeah, very true. Well, we're almost at the end of our...
You have the challenging chart there as an example.
They did, yeah. Yeah. Well, we're almost at the end of our time here. It's really flown by. So you've written two books here, The Inner Journey, Pathways to the Higher Self, and Greek Hero Myths, Symbols of Transformation, which are obviously great. I will put links to them in the show notes. Is there other
ways? That's very kind. They're available from Bardeen Douglas Baker Books. The reason that I wrote on the Greek hero myths, I have an interest in the hero quest and how the various hero myths of our world describe the process of spiritual transformation. And, you know, the hero ventures into this mythic landscape and confronts many tyrants, villains, and monsters. And of course, these are all within our own psyche, just as are the helpful gods and goddesses. They're all symbols of this process of treading the path. And when the hero attains or fulfills the quest, they then return to humanity to offer enlightenment. Joseph Campbell's a great person to read there, the 20th century mythographer. I very much liked him. But I feel it's important studying myth and asking ourselves what the myths mean to us. How do these characters resonate within our own psyche? And when we do so, we are beginning to function at the level of abstract thought, which is beyond the intellect. That's why dream symbolism, interpreting dreams, etc., is very important, because we have to think abstractly. We cannot do it in a cookbook manner or in a linear manner. We're operating at a different level, the higher mind, which is an aspect of the soul, and it's related to the antakarana, or link between soul and personality. I'm digressing somewhat, but that's why I feel it's important to study hero myths or myths in general, but ask what the characters mean to you. For example, Hercules has to overcome this hideous hydra that resides within a swamp, i.e. the lower unconscious, and it appears to be comprised of the foulest thoughts humanity could conceive of. And we must all confront our own hydra that is blocking the pathway to initiation. But your hydra is going to be different to mine. You've had a different upbringing to me. You have different psychological predispositions. Perhaps something challenging that is difficult for you might be easy for me, or what is challenging for me, you might think, well, why is he finding that difficult? You know, because we each have our own existential psyche.
So it's
a fascinating exercise. But with the myths, the secret is to ponder on them, you know, identify with the hero, see if the quest resonates, find one that does, and become aware of these characters. They have general meaning, of course, but we'll find them cropping up in our lives, perhaps in our thoughts and predispositions, or perhaps we'll meet one of these characters through someone in the outer world who embodies those characteristics, or at least to us they do. But of course, a lot of it is psychological projection.
Well, it's fascinating. And I'm looking on your page on the Theosophical Society in the UK, and you lecture on about 20 different subjects. So I think we'll definitely have to get you back on the show, and we'll talk about a few more.
Well, it's been an absolute pleasure meeting you, Jack. And
likewise.
I hope the weather's lovely in Italy. It's just a bit damp here. It's not particularly cold by Scottish standards. It's just a bit damp.
The society get up to Scotland quite a lot, because the Loch Ness is one of a major psychic center of the earth, and we put spiritual energy into the lock. They own a boat there, and they go out on the lock.
Oh, right. So it's about 3 hours from me, Loch Ness.
Oh, wonderful. Beautiful part of the world, eh?
Yeah.
Wonderful. Well, thanks so much, Gary, and we'll chat again soon.
My pleasure, Jack, and very nice to meet you, and you take care, and I wish you every success in your spiritual endeavors.
All right. So I'll put links to those show notes and link to your Theosophical page. And if people want to learn more about the Aetherius Society, they can go to aetherius.org. Thanks, Gary.
Thanks very much. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
Bye.